going to talk for about 15, 20 minutes maybe about Wabi Sabi. Just say a few things about it that hopefully will evoke the spirit a little bit and connect it up a little bit more with these three lakshanas and vimokshas that we have heard about in the meditations, of three marks of conditioned existence and the three doorways to liberation. So just to say before I start, most of what I say about Wabi Sabi comes from this little book. So those of you who become intrigued and want to find out more, not much has been written about Wabi Sabi, because the whole thing about Wabi Sabi is it's meant to be sort of natural and quite ephemeral and not written down, not defined and fixed. So there isn't much written down about it. But this little brown book is actually very famous. The little brown book, it's called, about Wabi Sabi, so it's worth looking for. It's written by a man called, not Leonard Cohen, but Leonard Koren. Similar, so you might be able to remember his name, and I'll read a little few sections of that book, because very beautifully, I think he does capture the spirit of Wabi Sabi, if the spirit of Wabi Sabi can be captured. Yeah, that book I would definitely take on a desert island with me. It would be one of my desert island books. And so the first thing to say, I suppose, about Wabi Sabi is it's two words, Wabi and Sabi, Japanese words. And literally translated, Wabi means kind of alone, away from society, and usually sort of somewhere in nature. That's roughly the translation of Wabi. And Sabi originally meant kind of lean, withered, or poor. So it was actually started off as quite a kind of negative, kind of slightly miserable word in a way. And then the two words were gradually combined and took on a more positive meaning of kind of a melancholy beauty. Or you could think of it as kind of a spirit of elegant simplicity. And that sort of happened gradually. That it's this kind of very unrefined, imperfect, natural kind of state, which is simple, but elegant and beautiful. And it's kind of a Zen concept. So Zen Buddhism is a school of Buddhism, and it first developed in India, actually. Not many people know that. Soon after the Buddha's Parinirvana, so after the Buddha died in a way, it arose as a way of life, and it was a way of life centered mainly around directly experiencing the truths of the Buddha's teaching rather than just intellectually understanding them in a kind of rational manner, but more really living his teachings. And from India, Zen traveled to China in about the 6th century and then subsequently to Japan from the 12th century onwards. And Zen is now very associated with China and Japan. It was sort of Buddhism took on aspects of Chinese and Japanese culture, and Zen is kind of quite an expression of that now. And the spirit of Zen has been expressed kind of in quite a nutshell in this other. This is also quite a good book about Wabi Sabi, if some of you want to sort of have a look at these books afterwards, by Andrew Juniper. And he gave quite a good definition of what the Zen way of being consists of, the Zen view of the world. So people who would follow the way of Zen would believe that we're living under the illusion that the world is dualistic, and that this illusion, to think that there's us and then there's the world, causes people to cling to the idea of themselves and the material world as separate, and that leads to suffering. That life is evanescent and fleeting, but overcoming the fear of death is vital for the fulfillment of life. So we have to kind of accept that life is fleeting and overcome the fear of life ending. And that through meditation and great effort, it's possible to break the chains of our perception and to realize the true nature of our reality. In so doing, it releases us from suffering that comes from this misunderstanding. So basically, Zen says that the reason for our suffering is just this misunderstanding that we're separate from the world rather than that we're interconnected with the world. And if we can overcome that misunderstanding, then we can live a much more contented life, basically. So I just want to read you my favourite story from this little brown book, which I think really, better than any sort of rational explanation, really captures the spirit of wabi-sabi. So I'll just read this out. It says, "What is the universe like? Things are either devolving toward or evolving from nothingness. As dusk approaches in the hinterlands, a traveller ponders shelter for the night. He notices tall rushes growing everywhere, so he bundles an armful together as they stand in the field and knots them at the top. Presto, a living grass hut. The next morning, before embarking on another day's journey, he unknots the rushes and presto, the hut deconstructs, disappears, and becomes a virtually indistinguishable part of the larger field of rushes once again. The original wilderness seems to be restored, but minute traces of the shelter remain, a slight twist or bend in a reed here and there. There's also the memory of the hut in the mind of the traveller, and in the mind of the reader reading this description. Wabi-sabi, in its purest, most idealized form, is precisely about these delicate traces, this faint evidence at the borders of nothingness." That really captures it. So something that is just a tiny trace. It's a little bit like... It particularly, I suppose, that story captures the idea of insubstantiality and sort of trying to leave no tracks or almost no tracks as you live. So it continues, "While the universe destructs, it also constructs. New things emerge out of nothingness. But we can't really determine by cursory observation whether something's in the evolving or the devolving mode. If we didn't know differently, we might mistake the newborn baby, small, wrinkled, bent, a little grotesque looking, for the very old man on the brink of death. In representations of wabi-sabi, the devolving dynamic generally tends to manifest itself in things a little bit darker, more obscure and quiet. And things evolving tend to be a little lighter and brighter, a bit clearer, and slightly more eye-arresting. And nothingness itself, instead of being empty space as in the West, is alive with possibilities. So in metaphysical terms, wabi-sabi suggests that the universe is in constant motion towards or away from potential." So there is also this idea of emptiness or shunyata, of nothingness, not being a negative thing, but being something full of potential. And I haven't got a picture of it, but there is, Zen is often, the main image in Zen, the main symbol of it, is a circle. It's kind of a circle with a bit of a gap at the top. You might have seen that. And that really expresses that, you know, that life is empty in that it's insubstantial, but that isn't negative. It's full of potential, full of possibilities. So it's kind of a space full of possibilities. And that's what the spirit of wabi-sabi is trying to express as well. So in the 16th century in Japan, the tea ceremony, it was something that still happens today in Japan. The tea ceremony had become very, very famous and very sumptuous. And at the time, the tea masters were trying to surpass each other in building bigger and bigger and shinier and glossier tea huts and using more expensive utensils and materials to impress each other, compete with each other, impress the people who were coming to their tea ceremonies, often government officials. And came to the tea ceremonies. And then a counter-movement started, and there was a tea master called Rikyu, who came to be very closely connected with the wabi-sabi aesthetic. And Rikyu started this counter-movement to the tea ceremony, having become more and more elitist and shiny and perfect. And he started using really humble, worn and natural materials and utensils, sort of wooden or clay bowls that had cracks in them, etc. And he stripped everything down to the bare essentials with this aim of elegant simplicity. And he said the tea ceremony has completely lost its spirit with this shininess. This is what it's meant to be. It's meant to show what's essential. There's not meant to be anything extraneous. There's not meant to be anything that's not necessary. So in Rikyu and the subsequent tea masters, Wabi Sabi tea masters, tea ceremonies, you walked through this Zen garden, so a minimalist garden. Then you had to bend low to get into the tea hut, and it would be quite dark. There would maybe be one candle, one scroll with a haiku poem. There'd be one vase of flowers, and there was this particular flower arranging as another Japanese art, but there's one particular method of flower arranging, which I can't remember the Japanese word, but the translation is just thrown together. So it's just the flowers just thrown into the vase in a natural way rather than in any way sort of artfully arranged. So he stripped everything down to essentials, brought it back to its naturalness, and he was very famous for that. So every small detail of the ceremony then became a deep appreciation of the fleetingness and imperfection of life and the beauty hidden just in the natural flow of life. And Koren in the little brown book puts it as, wabi-sabi is exactly about the delicate balance between the pleasure we get from things and the pleasure we get from the freedom from things. So again, it's just that little, that boundary between something and nothing, little tiny trace, that's important. There's one example of Riku's son one day. There's different versions of the story, but one version is that Riku's son, who was learning from his father how to become a tea master, he'd been asked to prepare the garden for the tea ceremony. So he was raking up, very carefully raking up all the leaves around the tree in the Zen garden, and absolutely perfectly had raked up every single leaf, and then was saying to his dad that he'd finished and was very proud. And his dad looked out of the window, frowned, went out and just slightly shook the tree so that just a few leaves sprinkled down, and said, no, now it's finished. So there's that little subtle, not perfect, you know, not quite perfect quality to wabi-sabi. So the little brown book also says that a certain mournful sounds are associated with wabi-sabi. So for example, the harsh cry of geese or seagulls or crows, or the forlorn sound of foghorns, says. And the other example that really surprised me that it was given was the wails of ambulance sirens echoing through the canyons of city streets. So that's quite surprising because it wasn't really taken from the natural world. But I think it points to this another aspect of wabi-sabi, which is that it's not so much about a quality inherent in any particular thing or place, but it's more about our human living relationship with what we hear, see, touch, taste, etc. It's with the emotional associations these sensations evoke in us. In relation to kind of the preciousness, the fragility, the vulnerability of life. So we can get that in a city environment just as much as in a natural environment, in a way, if we're sensitive to it. So translated into our perhaps more familiar Truvatna language here is, so if we're in an open and positive state of mind, suffused with metta and clear awareness, then even kind of seeing one falling leaf or hearing the cry of a seagull maybe can feel extraordinarily beautiful and meaningful. And it can put us in touch with what truly matters, that which is that we're alive and the universe is alive and everything is constantly revolving in this complex interconnected rhythm. So everything's always coming into being or arising and falling, just like our theme at the moment. Everything's always arising or it's dying away, and it's a cycle, basically, and it's interconnected. And Zen poets like Ryokan, the poem I read out in the meditation was a Ryokan poem, or Iku, who was also known as Crazy Cloud, in response to this kind of aesthetic, this wabi-sabi aesthetic, they lived very spontaneous lives, and they tried to respond to each moment fully and deeply, as if it was their last moment and nothing else mattered. So the name for this way of living, which is a particular Zen way of living, is Rushen, and it translates as crazy wisdom. So there are some stories about Ryokan, for example, living like that. So Ryokan lived in a hut, basically, in the wilderness, and he owned nothing but his robes and his begging bowl. So he lived properly as a kind of Buddhist hermit. But he was very well known for being very playful and actually not always that mindful. So there are kind of stories about him losing his begging bowl. He very often lost his begging bowl because he set out to beg for his food, and then he would come across the village children playing on the meadow, for example, and he'd just join in with them and put his begging bowl down and then forgotten where he'd put it and forgot to eat, etc. So he would often just totally spontaneously follow the moment. Or another really lovely story about Ryokan. Although he lived as a hermit, he did have friends sometimes coming to visit him in his hut, other hermits, I guess. So there was this friend of him had visited him, and Ryokan had said, "Oh, I'll go into the village and I'll get us some wine." And he'd set off, and his friend was sitting in the hut waiting for him. And then hours later, his friend thought, "Goodness, he's not returned. You know, what's happened to him?" So he went out to look for him, and Ryokan was standing at the bottom of the garden, gazing at the full moon. And his friend was saying, "Where's the wine?" And he hadn't made it to the village. He just got to the bottom of the garden and got totally carried away by the beauty of the moon. So there's these lovely stories about him. So I hope you can see the sort of connection between wabi-sabi and the Buddhist teaching of the three lakshanas and the three vimokshas that I've mentioned at the start of the evening. So to my mind, wabi-sabi and the Zen aesthetic are sort of the poetic living expression of these teachings. They've got this aim towards revealing the mysterious beauty and significance within this fleeting world, is a line that often occurs in Zen poems. So the beauty in the world rather than somewhere outside of it in some different perfect realm. So from the Zen or the wabi-sabi point of view, insight and even full enlightenment is gained by adjusting your point of view towards trusting and accepting the uncertainty of constant change and flow, and sort of finding a delight in this rather than trying to fix things the way we want them, or cling to them, or wanting them to stay the same, but to just basically delight in the constant flow of things. So I just want to end with a quote by there's a great Zen master, Dogen, who some of you might have come across, and he is another person, I think, who lived in this kind of crazy wisdom kind of a way and wrote like that as well. And I think he evokes sort of one more wabi-sabi example from Japanese culture, which prevails to this day. So people still to this day rush out in Japan when it's the cherry blossom time, and they picnic under the flowering cherry trees, and they're absolutely delighted about the falling petals and the beauty, and nowadays I think take lots of pictures of them on their mobile phones, which is quite funny. But, you know, they find the cherry trees so beautiful because they only last for a day or two and then all the petals have fallen. So actually that makes it more precious. So Dogen's piece is actually about a plum tree, but I think it captures the deeper meaning of this cherry blossom tradition quite beautifully. So I'll just read that out. This old plum tree is boundless. All at once its blossoms open, and of itself the fruit is born. It forms spring, it forms winter, it arouses wind and wild rain. It becomes grass and trees, it becomes pure fragrance. Its whirling, miraculous transformation has no limit. Furthermore, the treeness of the great earth, high sky, bright sun and clear moon, derives from the treeness of the old plum tree. They always have been entangled, vine with vine. When the old plum tree suddenly opens, the world of blossoming flowers arises. There is a single blossom that opens five blossoms. There are three, four, five blossoms, hundreds, thousands, myriads, countless blossoms. Blossoming is the old plum tree's offering.